We are here in the Princeton Public Library on April 26th for an oral history as part of the Voices of Princeton project and the partner project with the Jewish Community Foundation of Greater Mercer. My name is Kim Dorman. I'm here as the facilitator, and I'm here with Luke Antwerk, Barbara Vilcomerson, and Peter Epstein.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Luke Antwerk, and I'll be interviewing Barbara and Peter, and they will now introduce themselves. Barbara, why don't you introduce yourself first?
I'm Peter's younger sister. I'm Jess Marion's daughter, and I am now Barbara Vilcomerson.
And I'm Peter Epstein, who grew up in Princeton, left town to go to college, and just returned in my dotage a few years ago to hometown USA. And we have a younger sister, Judith, who Barbara's just 2 years younger than me. I was born in 1941, and we have a younger sister who was born in 48 and lives in Boulder, Colorado.
Thank you. So we're interviewing numbers of people, but this is the only interview we're going to do with siblings. And so it's a first for all of us. Just for the record, you've each been interviewed individually. And so this will be a conversation about the interviews and about your lives together as siblings. So were you wondering what the other person had said?
Absolutely.
Yes.
But I also think it's probably the only interview where I can complain that he and his friends put fried worms down my back.
Oh, no.
That we what?
Put fried worms down my back.
Oh, right.
You were going to say something.
No, I don't remember. I have no recollection of that whatsoever. I mean, to quote Peter Lorre, I'm innocent.
I'm very curious about what he said.
Uh-huh. And did you have another story you wanted to tell that you were sort of what Barbara read on your
notes? No, well, I have some things I didn't mention that if we have an opportunity to weave them into our narrative, I will.
Okay.
But please proceed.
Actually, I remember now that we had 4-H clubs and grew our gardens and took our vegetables to the state fair to be judged. And
yeah, and I actually, I think I mentioned in my earlier talk that we moved out to Little Brook Road, and it was sort of on the edge of the build-up part of Princeton at that time. And yeah, it was the 4-H Club. We had a county agricultural agent that would actually come around and visit our little vegetable gardens. And I think one of my claims to fame was actually coming in second in the 4-H State Insect Identification Contest.
And I won a blue prize for my cucumber. It was the largest one they'd ever seen.
Okay. Well, that was good. Congratulations. So, what was it?
You never thought of us as being in a 4-H club, did you, Luke?
No, it's a totally different experience. So, Barbara had, one of the things Barbara said was that following you made her life a little easier. That you were sort of active and had leadership roles in school, and that following you made it easier for our teachers knew about you, so they ascribed certain qualities to her that she may or may not have had. So maybe we could talk a little bit about what that was like. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I think we discussed earlier, and on one hand, you know, I didn't experience any anti-Semitism, but I was self-conscious about being Jewish and also being short. But at the same time, I was sort of the big man on campus. So my memory is in eighth grade, I ran for class president, and for my speech, I wrote a doggerel, which
in
pleased
poetry.
Everybody.
Yeah.
And after that, it became the thing to elect me president of the class. So all the way through high school, I was either class president or president of student council, so I wasn't really, can't claim I was discriminated against as a Jew, but I was always very self-conscious of being short. And actually, one funny story that involves Barbara about that is
at Ellen Patrone.
That we won't mention her name,
yep.
But I came back from my mother's funeral, and you know, gave a little memorial talk, and a classmate of Barbara's attended the service, and afterwards she told Barbara that she had had a crush on me, evidently, and her memory of me, for the audience, in my prime, I was maybe pressing 5'7". I'm now probably 5'5½ at a stretch. And her memory of me was that I was over 6 feet tall.
That's true. And I remember the doggerel from eighth grade.
Yeah.
I do. And we had a social studies teacher named Mr. Hope, who also taught square dancing. And he called Peter Epi, after our uncle, who was called Epi. And then I have still a few friends left who refer to me as Little Epi.
Yeah. You know, that was a nickname part of the way through high school. You know, square dancing was funny. We moved, I think I mentioned that we grew up on Jefferson Road, and when I was going into eighth grade and Barbara was going into sixth grade, we moved out to Littlebrook Road. Shifted school systems in those days, so we went to Valley Road School. And I hadn't really discovered girls yet, and one of the main activities there was at noontime there was a square dancing club, and they asked who wanted to join, and I discovered afterwards that there were only David Wigner and I were the only two people in the whole, I was sixth grade when we went.
I was
in sixth grade, you were in fourth grade. So I discovered David Wigner and I were the only sixth graders who hadn't volunteered, and I remember sitting in Mr. Hope was my home room teacher, sitting in a room, and I could look out the window down in the gymnasium where all these boys and girls were square dancing, and it was my first realization I was missing out on something.
So what was it like for you? Were you a square dancer?
Yes. Yeah, I love square dancing. It was a big deal. That and volleyball, dodgeball.
Yeah. Square dancing was really the initiation through the school system, yeah, to heterosexual social relations.
Yeah. It wasn't until the high school that we had started having school dances.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think he had to persuade his friends to dance with me.
Right.
He thinks I don't know.
Did you look up to him as a...
Absolutely. Of course. I mean, he was a very good brother. I mean, he teased me a lot, but we really did play together quite a bit, you know, before he sort of took off with his friends and he was older and I was older. But when we were on Jefferson Road, we were sort of in a tumble of people all together across a certain amount of ages. Again, our sister was enough younger that it was sort of a different group of people. But, you know, the Hewletts were there, the shoe store people. And I mean, we all just, it was across ages, not just a few.
Yeah. I mean, a couple
of
things.
There just weren't enough kids, so that we all played together.
Actually, a couple of memories that Barbara may share and be able to elaborate on from Jefferson Road. One was that, you know, in those days we only had vaccinations primarily against smallpox, and so
polio.
Every year polio was a big fear, and often the swimming pool. There was a swimming pool out where the Eve Craft Tennis Center was. That was the main swimming pool in town, but I remember a number of summers that would be shut down because of polio epidemics. And also chickenpox and measles were a big thing at elementary school. And I remember we had this sort of strange epidemiological phenomena on our block on Jefferson Road. Bobby Rugg lived two doors down from us, and he was the first, I think this was when I was in first or second grade, you were probably still in kindergarten. Anyway, Bobby Rugg got measles, and for some reason it went counterclockwise around Hawthorne Street, Moore Street, and ended up at our house. And then just as I was recovering and Barbara from measles, Bobby Rugg got the chicken pox, and it went around the block. But, I mean, it was really a huge epidemic, and I remember going back to school at one point, and out of a class of 25 kids, there were maybe only three kids that showed up.
I was in grade school when the polio vaccine came in, and they didn't ask for permission or anything else. They just said, go to the nurse's office, and there was two lines and a nurse on either end, and you rolled up whichever sleeve was towards the nurse, and that was that. I mean, and everybody was thrilled. I thought you were going to talk about the fact that our sister ran naked down. She escaped. She was roly-poly, and she was, I guess, bathing in one of those big ash can tubs, and she wanted to play with us, so it didn't bother her. She had no clothes on, and she escaped down the block. And what I remember is the argument as Peter and three of his friends carried her home was who was going to take the arms and who was going to take the legs. I was at the end of third grade. I guess you were at the end of fifth grade when we moved.
Yeah.
And I talked about just roaming around in the backwoods by ourselves, and the dogs roamed with us.
But also Princeton was quiet enough in those days that we used to play touch football out in Jefferson Road, definitely on Hawthorne Street, and there was a little empty lot just about three doors down from Wiggins that was kind of the baseball field when we were in elementary school.
I want to ask you a question. I wasn't sure I was going to bring it up, but you already brought it up, so I will. You said you were self-conscious about being Jewish. I was not, and with our sister, like when around the anniversary of our parents' deaths, we usually have a Zoom call. He's usually someplace else, and one of those, about a year ago, I guess, we started talking about what it felt to be Jewish in Princeton. And I was amazed, particularly you, because you had been being young. They both, Judith 4 years younger when there were more Jews, and Peter older than me, both talked about feeling self-conscious about being Jewish in Princeton, and I had not. And you just mentioned it again. So what
did that take?
Yeah,
I think it really emerged, you know, at the dating age. And so, you know, there'd be some girls that just I couldn't get to first base with. That was the metaphor in the day. We won't go into what second, third, and fourth base were. But and I remember homeroom was always alphabetical, and Adele Dark always sat in front of me, who was very attractive. She may have been the only Mormon in the school, but I could never get her to, you know, spend any time with me. So I think I always, you know, was projecting, you know, is it me personally? I think I mentioned this earlier, is it me personally, or, you know, is somebody's parents not wanting them to go out and date somebody that was Jewish? On the other hand, we did get invited to these cotillions.
Oh, so he did go to the cotillions.
Were a big thing in those days. And I think a lot of them were sponsored by the DAR.
Yes.
And that's where I also was very self-conscious. I mean, rent a tuxedo and the girls in evening gowns and corsages and
clubs.
I think I remember once I was a freshman at university and Barbara got invited to one that was in the Nassau Tavern when that still existed on Alexander Street.
No, that was a dead
I mean, not Princeton Inn. And I came home for Christmas vacation, and this thing was the next day, and somehow I could only get a tuxedo which was about 6 inches longer than my arm. And I remember going through the reception line, I'd have to go jerk my arm up in the air to get my hand out.
That was actually somebody's debutante party.
Yeah.
Somebody I'd known in high school. Had, you know, she was like 18, and I mean, it was very odd. But he did have this long sleeve, it's true.
So
I talked about the cotillions, and I said I couldn't remember whether you had gone to them or not, but they had disappeared by the time our sister came through.
Yeah. Yeah, they were usually held at one, either at the Nassau Tavern or at the Princeton Inn in a, you know, kind of a ballroom setting. They would be chaperoned.
I just had a sudden Jewish memory from my parents who lived next door to the Trakeviches. He was a chemistry professor at the university, and she taught Russian at Rutgers. And they'd actually lived next door to us on Jefferson Road, and then we moved next door to each other. So the families were friendly. I'm still friendly with their daughter. Anyway, I remember my mother saying, and she was a little bit upset about it, that there had been a movie of one of the Philip Roth books was made into a movie, whatever it was. And Mila Tkavich telling my mother that she, and proudly that her Jews were not like that at all.
Yeah.
Which she found intensely irritating.
Right. These things have a way of
right.
creeping out into our consciousness.
Well, Barbara mentioned something about pets and dogs. You know, one thing that's really, and we were talking earlier about things that have changed, not just in Princeton, but pretty much universally. In those days, if you had a dog, you could just open the door and let him out. And, you know, they would disappear for a couple of days. And in most cases, they would reappear. And the same thing, and certainly when we moved out to Littlebrook Road, where it was more woods and everything, and the dogs would run, bring back rabbits that they caught. And as an adult, I never wanted to have a dog because I could never relate to having to go out, you know, two or three times a day and walk it around the block on a leash with a plastic bag in my hand.
That's funny because when we did have a dog and we had a smallish, I mean, we had a pretty big party. I never thought about the fact that I had to walk this. I mean, to me, it was you opened the door and the dog came back when they wanted. I mean, it was really.
Yeah. And, you know, this is where I don't think, you know, I don't think objectively small town, I mean, Princeton's larger, considerably larger than it was then, but in terms of both what we were talking about earlier, about letting kids roam around and walk places by themselves, or letting dogs out without a leash, I don't think any Princeton's any more dangerous or that much more crowded from a dog pet perspective than it was in the 40s or 50s. But as a society, we've just become, you know, incredibly paranoid. And I kind of attribute it to, I don't know what decade it was, when they started putting the photos of missing children on milk cartons. And
it was that one little boy who disappeared, Eddie and Pets, who went.
Yeah, and then there are the rumors, and then I don't remember whether it was an urban legend or true, but sometime in the 60s or so, there were rumors about during Halloween, kids getting razor blades and apples. So from then on, that was, I always suspected it was promoted by the Mars Candy Company, because ever after, everybody would only, you know, you were only allowed to offer pre-wrapped commercial candies to kids instead of homemade cookies and fruit.
That is actually something about Halloween. It always struck me about that when you asked about the difference of raising kids. I mean, Halloween, we just went out and some places gave handful of corn and candies. And then when I was a little older, we did soliciting for UNICEF. And again, we were just dropped off in some neighborhood and nobody supervised us or anything else. And you do it with kids now and the parents come around with them. I mean, it's, it fostered a different kind of independence. Also, you know, nobody arranged activities for you. We didn't go to summer camp. You took care of your own, kept yourself occupied.
So one memory of Barbara, we were talking earlier about how there were more, you know, regular neighborhood kind of stores on Nassau Street back in the 50s and 40s. And Barbara always stood out in my mind. She used to go to the butcher shop and he would give her raw liver that she would.
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
Now, I do remember having books, putting stamps in books that were eventually went to the bank to buy treasury bonds.
And on the store, the after, for the high school kids, the big hangouts, there was a bowling alley sort of where, what's the tavern's name?
Triumph,
where that was on, I guess it still is on Nassau Street. Mm-hmm. So that used to be a big hangout. And then there was a soda fountain called Renwick's that had a tile front. I think the facade still exists. Yeah. But I think Renwick's was a major high school hangout. What was the other one that was popular? Well, and then we had two movie theaters. Mm-hmm. We had the Garden Theater where it was now. And then a
Playhouse.
And then there was a larger one where the Whole Fish development is now on Whole Fish Street. And, you know, of course, in the 40s and 50s, you got new movies almost
twice
every other day, and it was a weekly
But we didn't go, I mean, I didn't go that often. Our parents were not moviegoers. You probably went more often.
No, I think I resented that the first movie I went to, you went to at the same time, even though I was 2 years older.
Bambi.
It was Bambi, yeah. I haven't gotten over that yet.
So what I remember is that when that groundbreaking for the Jewish Center that I mentioned, I was a freshman in high school, so Peter was a junior, and he and I and Alan Goodhart and Arnold Orkin went to the movies afterwards, and it was a double feature of Shane and the African Queen, which were very memorable, very, very memorable. Do you remember, I mean, you remember, like, there being board meetings in our house and stuff, but I talked about your bar mitzvah in terms of how mom invited people and how low-key it was. Was that a big deal for you, the bar mitzvah?
No, it was just the preparation for it was, you know, a little burdensome. But
our grandmother came. We didn't see
it wasn't
our
parents. You know, I mean, it was a major milestone, certainly.
We were closer to my mother's family growing up because both of her sisters lived in the New York area, while our grandmother and grandfather, he died when I was about, I don't know, six or seven. We were still on Jefferson Road. And our grandmother, I mean, she didn't speak English, and she lived in Ohio. And we drove out there two or three times, and then she moved to California with my father's younger sister.
No, in those days, it was, like, you know, Eisenhower hadn't gotten around to starting the interstate highway system. So to go visit Cincinnati, it was a two-day trip.
Yeah.
And you would go on the New York, on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and then the rest of the way on local roads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talking about the movie theaters reminds me of going back to the neighborhood, and you may remember this. So I mentioned earlier our father worked at RCA on the development of radio transmitters, and TVs after World War II were just coming into circulation. So this must be as early as... As I mentioned, I was born in 41, Barbara was born in 43. This is probably 47 or so. TVs weren't really commercially available. There were maybe 2 or 3 hours of programming a day on one or two channels, including, I think, Captain Video and Howdy Doody.
Howdy Doody. The TVs
were
so like this.
And so at RCA, where my father was, they had a early television that they let different employees take home, and it would rotate. It would stay one or two months with one family. It would go to another. They were like huge wooden boxes with a screen that was about 6 inches wide. But when that came to our house, we became, you know, celebrities for 3 or 4 blocks. So every time Howdy Doody was on, we'd have like 20 kids.
We'd only be allowed to invite
the whole neighborhood would be gathered around.
So do you remember doing a magic show in the basement?
Oh, yeah, that was a fraudulent magic show.
But that was when the coal shuttles would, when they would fill up with the coal, and my grandfather would make what we called poison ivy soap out of the ashes because it would take your skin off. Peter had a magic show.
Yeah,
we made popcorn.
Tom Borger, who is the son of a high school teacher, lived across the street, and I had a magic. I think we only memorized about 3 or 4 tricks, and we created this, hung up all these blankets in the basement, and invited the neighborhood kids. But
and charged admission.
I think we charged admission, and we had a concession stand too. But
so
it was fairly fraudulent.
I can't help wondering about what dinner conversations were around the family with, you know, 3 sort of active, involved, you know, kids.
Sat down to dinner every single night
as a family.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what was that like? What do you remember about that? What kinds of...
I mean, I think it was really a central part of growing up. And I think I've read studies later that, you know, one of the best predictors of academic success in life is whether a family eats meals together and talks about things or not. And that certainly was the case. But we had an interesting... Our grandfather had been in the business of importing...
asbestos.
Graphite from Germany to make pencils in the U.S. And as as someone named Greenbaum, that wasn't a good business to be in the 1930s. So he was prematurely retired and kind of lost most of the money he had. So he came to live with my parents shortly after we moved to Princeton, and he lived to be, I think he was
99.
Yeah, but so that was 1942. He was born in 76. So he was already in his 60s or so, but he lived to be 99. So he was there and a big presence while we were growing up. But he and my mother were quite intellectual. And so, I mean, we had sort of an unusual family dynamic where my mother, I mentioned, was better educated than my father, but also just more interested in intellectual conversation. And but we always had, you know, those dinner table conversations were a big part of growing up, very serious discussions about, you know, mostly politics, but other things as well.
I wanted to go back to the TV thing because Dad also borrowed a color, one of the first color TVs that were getting ready to be commercialized for Queen Elizabeth's coronation. So we were already, and we got to see that in color live. And his claim to fame was that he was part of the group that designed the antenna that was on top of the Empire State Building. Yeah. And so he was there to install
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I talked about that.
You talked about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of the, it's interesting that the two of you had, some of these memories are family memories that you share.
Well, but Peter destroyed our family memories because when Dad turned to 80, we had a family party, just his brother came to surprise him. And Peter said that we should each share our favorite memory of Dad, the funniest one, the thing we never told you to now, the thing that made us angriest. And I lost my childhood because we would take turns going around telling these stories. And no matter what we said, one of my parents would say, that didn't happen like that. So it was really quite an interesting exercise in memory that, you know, that's why I was curious about what he said, because some of our memories are the same or some are different.
Yeah.
Did you feel you were discriminated against because you're Jewish when you applied to the small
universities
like Williams and
Amherst?
Without
a doubt, because I applied to Harvard, Yale, Amherst, and Columbia, and I got into Harvard early admissions in Columbia. I mean, Harvard, when I ended up there, maybe 20% of the class was Jewish or more. And I got turned down at, you know, Yale and Amherst were accepting almost no Jewish students in those days. And I remember getting a letter from Amherst saying, I think I mentioned earlier that of the top 25 people in my high school class, 23 were girls, so I was like number 23 or something. And but I had all this great resume. But I got a letter from Amherst telling me that I hadn't lived up to my potential, you know, that my SAT scores, my grades didn't live up to my SAT scores, and that's why I didn't get in. But anyway.
It's amazing that they would write that kind of thing. Nobody would write that now. That doesn't.
So,
that was when you asked about, you know, what high school thing. The kids in high school were really smart. I mean, there was really. I thought the classes were.
Yeah.
You know, we had some really, really good teachers, and I remember taking ancient history in my freshman year, and then world history, and they had probably five or six different languages available. It was very, very different. From a lot of the schools that were local.
Yeah. But I always thought the high school's reputation was due more to the fact that there's a lot of kids of professors. You know, it had less to do with the faculty or the curriculum or anything, which I thought was just pretty much the standard vanilla New Jersey required reading. Mm-hmm. You know, Romeo, Juliet in sophomore year, and My Antonia in freshman year.
Silas.
And Ivanhoe. one thing some of my biggest memories of high school were two sort of events in Princeton history that have resulted in deaths of people in the high school. I don't know if you remember these. So one was, there was a big hurricane in 55. I think it was Hurricane Diane. And there was a boy named Pat Mahoney whose family had a house. You know, when you go where the lake comes out to Nassau Street or Route 27, and then as you go towards Kingston, there are a few houses between the road and the lake and the dam, just where the dam is, and then it turns into a river again. So anyway, we had a hurricane there, and the water, basically the river was up at the level of the lake, and Pat Mahoney and another boy named Bob Speedy, who were among the most popular, I think Pat Mahoney was president of his class. He was a year older than me, and Bob Speedy, they're both very popular students, and they decided to go out in a raft or a boat, and they were drowning, and a policeman tried to rescue them, and all three of them drowned. So that was
very traumatic.
I think the first and only real encounter I had as a teenager with...
No, there was the kid who was electrocuted.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, there was a... Yeah, I remember, that's right. Somebody else we knew tried to climb a wall with a downed electric wire and was electrocuted.
And the Jenkins twins.
But and the other event, which you may not remember, but in those days, most of the kids, you know, 75 or 80% of the kids were in the academic track at the high school. The high school had three tracks. It had the academic, it had a business, and then it had a general education. That some of the working class kids were kind of directed towards, and most of the minority kids, so most of the kids dressed in standard white bucks, was sort of dirty white bucks was the standard shoe wear for boys, and khakis, and I think you had to wear a shirt with a collar in those days, but. There was a small kind of working class element that was precociously into the Fonz culture. You remember the Fonz from Happy Days, black leather jackets and slick back hair. And four or five of them were, after they got their driver's license, their junior or senior year, were speeding on Route 20. Also, this also happened almost in the same area in 27, and they drove into a telephone pole and everybody in the car was killed. And so I remember their friends formed a group in their memory called the Road Angels, and they would go around helping motorists that had broken down. And I remember one of them telling me, like a typical thing, they would be driving along, and it'd be some guy who had his hood up by the side of the car, and these four guys in leather jackets would jump out with wrenches in their hand, and the guy would run in the woods to escape.
The road from Kingston into Princeton, the old road is still there. People walk on it, but it was very, very dangerous.
Is that where the accident happened?
Yeah.
So what do you remember? What was the response of the community when those two popular boys drowned?
There were no grievance counselors.
I remember high school yearbook, I think.
Yeah.
The dedication to...
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember anything... You know, it was just something we were all very aware of and kind of shaken by, but there was no group activity around it. I don't remember going to a funeral or being invited. But, you know, it definitely made an impression.
Do you remember on Jefferson Road? I mean, it was this transition from post-war to sort of a more, you know, rising economy, because we would still have, like, the knife sharpener would come on come down the street, and people would come out and have their scissors and knives sharpened and things like that. I mean, that's a change from now. Although you can take your knife now to the Ace Hardware, and they'll sharpen it for you. But.
Yeah. I mean, these aren't typically Princeton stories, but, you know, in the 40s, we still had the milk delivered in bottles to the door with the cream separated. You had to sort of shake it up.
Yep. Mom would pour the cream off from
the dad. We would get the
Iceman
would come because you'd have an ice refrigerator. So I think that all changed in the late, you know, I think it was in the 50s when you started having, got rid of the coal furnaces. Though I think I don't think that house while we lived there was ever converted.
Not on Jefferson.
So we moved out of there in probably 51. from Jefferson Road, but the new house had a, you know, gas heat.
We remember.
But shoveling coal was sort of a big, actually an exciting thing to do when you were
Peter worked on Kendall Park, nailing roofs on.
Oh, yeah, I spent 3 summers constructing Kendall Park.
So, did you guys ever argue?
What?
Did you ever argue with each other?
No. My memory was, you know, we all get along well with our younger sister, too.
Mad about it. I mean, yeah. Peter's 7 years older than she. And she was a full 4 years, but because I had skipped a grade, we were never in school together. And so to this day, she's still, you know, upset about being ignored by Peter, not by me so much, because she and I shared a bedroom.
But she and my younger sister used to really go at
it. She and I fought a lot.
They fought, and I think I developed this. To this day, I have this incredible ability where I can be in the middle of Penn Station and open a computer and do work. You know, I can concentrate anywhere. And I attribute it to the fact that when those two were arguing, I just learned to tune them out.
I think he could always just concentrate. But so when he went to college, I would move right into his room.
You had your own room for a while.
Yeah, room. You know, room for your own for a while.
Right.
Did we argue? I don't think we did.
You and I, we got along. We shared a bedroom for a while, and then...
Well, that was at Jefferson Road.
Yeah, Road.
I mean, he would scare me. He would try to scare me. I mean, like, we would lie in the shared bedroom, and he would tell me about there were snakes on the floor, things living under my... I mean, you know, he was an older brother, but he also looked out for me, let me ride on his handlebars home from school and stuff. So. And I talked about Grandpa a lot. Because as I said, you got to do sports with Dad, but he was very important to me. Mm-hmm. Are there other Jewish memories you have? There were people around who weren't affiliated with the center. I mean, I think it was, you know, we knew every Jewish kid in our class or not in our class, but there were a few people around who were Jewish but were not involved with the center.
Well, I mentioned there were famous ones like Oppenheimer's son and Wigner's son. But it was only in my class, out of 300 or maybe 3 or 4 other kids that had at least one Jewish parent. Oppenheimer, I mean, that was another thing growing up in Princeton when I had a science project in physics in my junior year in high school, I decided to just interview famous Princetonians. I just called Oppenheimer up on the phone, and I went over and with a tape recorder and talked to him for 2 hours, which was pretty cool. I didn't appreciate how unusual that was at the time. And unfortunately, I never said, you know, that tape probably went around for 3 or 4 moves as I got older, but at some point it disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Dad was at the labs, and they had a little separate research laboratory where they were doing these things. And we would go to pick him up, and we would have to say, we're picking up Jess Epstein, and they would, because it was secure work, and it wasn't air conditioned, and it was very, very hot, and Mom sent me in to get him one time, and they were all in their underwear with their shirts off. They were just, I mean, it was just definitely different. And
there was a big, I don't know if they still, now it's the Stanford Labs, a huge event for us every year was RCA would have an open house and then this picnic for the staff out there, and they would invite, and there would be a stage with magicians and
dancing.
Entertainers and dancing and pie eating contests, and that was a big deal. And visiting the open house, it's sort of funny. I think even back in the 50s or 60s, they had a track out there where they were testing self-driving cars in a way.
Would go, they would have a helicopter come up and down. We'd not seen a helicopter before. They would land on the land. And David and I shared a memory because both of our fathers could take a box of vacuum tubes and a diagram and pull the innards out of a TV and fix it, put it back together again. You remember Dad on his...
Yeah. I mean, another important aspect of growing up Jewish, in my personal experience, this isn't so much Princeton, but it's amusing. So both my sisters, you know, Barbara, you know David Vilcomerson, of course, Barbara's husband. So my father, Barbara was back here. My father basically invited David to dinner, so he basically fixed Barbara up on a blind date. And David, I mentioned earlier, my father's two passions in life were playing tennis and the Jewish community. Well, David is an excellent tennis and squash player, too. And unlike anyone in my family, he's fluent in Hebrew and a real biblical scholar, so he was maybe more Jewish than we were. And then my younger sister also married a Jewish tennis player. They were kind of quintessential hippies. In fact, my recollection is he played tennis barefoot on the Harvard tennis team. So both my, even though I was the oldest, they both got married younger than me to, you know, well-educated Jewish young men who were tennis players and Jewish. And so I used to joke that I could have married a hooker from Macau and my parents would have had nothing to complain about.
They were just happy you got married.
Right, that the girls did the right thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Other sort of a lot of your memories are similar. Yeah. You're only two years apart, and so it's interesting to hear that you've experienced these things.
Yeah, and I don't have a sense of the sociology. Way. I mean, I mentioned earlier, I don't know whether you can find streets where you know, 10 kids can come out on the same block and play together, whether that exists anywhere in Princeton today. But that's what Jefferson Road was like.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember when we moved, you and your friends would go down to the lake and clear off the snow and play hockey.
Yeah, that was almost a high point of the year where we would, I mean, the lake wouldn't every year, but most years it would freeze over two or three times, sometimes for as much as a month at a time. Mm-hmm. And you could skate from Washington Road down to the dam a lot of the times. And but the best thing for young guys who wanted to play hockey was to have it freeze totally clear, sort of real glassy mirror-like ice, and then have a light, heavy, fairly light snowfall, and then you could shovel out a rink where you could play hockey. If that didn't happen, and there was no snow, then when a puck went out of bounds, you'd have to chase it for half a mile. But then I was living in the Washington, D.C. area when my kids were growing up, and I kept wanting to bring them up here to go ice skating. And this was before anyone was worrying about climate change. This was mostly in the 80s and early 90s. And I remember it just seemed like there never was an occasion. I don't know whether people skate on the, it's even legal to skate on the lake in the winter now, but I don't think it happens very often. That was always my personal harbinger of climate change.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I think I didn't appreciate till I was married and older was that my grandfather came to live with my parents when they had only been married a couple of years. He was already living there when Peter was born. And when we grew up, there was no sense of, you know, him being in the way. I mean, he was sad in a way because he had no income and no thing by himself. But, I mean, we were so fortunate to grow up in this household. And the other thing I appreciate is my mother went back to work, I guess, when my sister was in about third grade. And she would come home, take off her coat, cook dinner for everybody, and, you know, then go out to her meetings and things like that. And it was just a very full, well-ordered life that it's hard to imagine the amount of energy it took to do all that. I certainly can't imagine doing it.
Well, good.
All right.
Well, thank you both. I mean, it'll be fun to listen to an interview with siblings who have similar memories with a slant and sort of on a track. So we appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, that was fun.